Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. When we heard the word resuscitation, we usually think of CPR, which stands for cardiopulmonary resuscitation. We have visions of chest compressions and mouth-to-mouth. In popular culture, we see mostly young, attractive medical professionals bearing defibrillator paddles on patients' chests and yelling, "Clear!" A New England Journal of Medicine study from 1996 compared the outcomes of CPR performed on television shows to real-world statistics. Perhaps unsurprisingly, resuscitations on television were anywhere from 2 to 4 times as likely to be successful. In all, 2/3 of the television efforts ended with a revived and recovered patient. In real life, the best urban emergency response systems succeed about 1/4 of the time. For patients in the hospital, figures vary, but survival rates are reported in the low single digits to around 15%. Pretty bleak numbers for what we term in-hospital arrest survivorship. Our guest today, David Casseret, explores these and other phenomena in his new book, Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead, just out from Current. Casseret is a professor of medicine and the director of hospice and palliative care for the University of Pennsylvania Health System. His book is part history, part science, and part superb reporting on his adventures learning about resuscitation and the related research fields of hibernation and hypometabolism, also known as suspended animation. As the New York Times noted in yesterday's review, Casseret has produced a travelogue about as comprehensive as possible without actually dying. David Casseret is our guest today over the phone from his home in Philadelphia on Studio Tulsa on Health. David Casseret, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
I like the new book very much, and I wonder, it's really a history as much as anything else about resuscitation. How did you develop your interest in resuscitation?
Well, I'm a hospice and palliative care doc, so I take care of patients who are, many of whom are near the end of life, who've decided they want to focus on comfort care. And I really, that's what I do every day. I take care of patients. And I really wanted to see the other side of that coin. I wanted to take a look at what medicine could do, what science might be able to do someday for us if we want aggressive treatment, if we want the most aggressive treatment possible. And I kind of wanted to take a look at what immortality might look like someday.
So there's some pretty surprising things in this book. For example, I had no idea that resuscitation started so many hundreds of years ago. I mean, I think of it as such a 20th century thing, but you taught me quite a few things that, for example, what they used to do in London and I guess in Amsterdam and then in Russia as well.
Yeah, the list of resuscitation techniques dating back a couple hundred years is actually pretty long. A better question is what didn't they do? Looking through a list of resuscitation techniques from the 18th century, it seems like they were trying pretty much everything. It almost seems like somebody would come up with an idea and say, that might work. And they gave it a try. Everything from using bellows to inflate the lungs, to rubbing people, to beating them with sticks, to putting their feet in boiling water, or my own personal favorite, throwing drowning victims over the back of a trotting horse. I actually tried that when I was researching the book, and I wouldn't recommend it.
What happened to you when you did that?
It's very, very hard to breathe when you're strapped to the back of a horse. That should come as a surprise to me. Is an indication that I didn't really think through the implications of that experiment before I tried it. So very, very hard to breathe, very, very hard to stay alert and conscious, and really not much fun.
Now, historically, there were some, you mentioned basically that almost everything was tried. And one of the things that I found kind of surprising, but in a strange way logical, was the use of smoke in resuscitation and in many different, I guess you could say, orifices. What was some of the rationale behind that, and what were they trying to do?
Well, I think one thing I've learned in looking through the history of resuscitation is that it's sometimes not helpful to look too hard for a rationale, because sometimes the justification for these techniques is really pretty hypothetical. But if you think about it, one of the effects of nicotine, one of the ingredients of tobacco smoke, is to affect the nerves that lead to the heart and increase your heart rate. You take a couple puffs on a cigarette and your heart rate goes up. And so for somebody who's just experienced a drowning, often one of the reflexes of drowning is a very, very slow heart rate. So you can imagine at least trying this on drowning victims and thinking, somebody who didn't have an apparent heartbeat before, smoke might help to get that heart rate back. You're probably not actually resuscitating anybody, but you're increasing their heart rate enough so you could detect it when you couldn't before, at least enough to give people the idea that this might be helpful.
Popular culture, you know, basically movies and television give us the idea that resuscitation, by which, you know, I should describe what this is, but we typically will see our televised or movie heroic doctors saying clear and then administering defibrillator paddles to the chest and miraculously forestalling death in the fictionalized patients on television or in the movies. But in reality, you cite a study that I believe had some researchers at the University of Chicago among them who found out that, you know, in television land, the success in resuscitation was much higher than it is in reality. What's the real life statistics on how successful CPR and resuscitation are?
You're right. This is a study that was done, gosh, about 15 years ago now by James Tulsky, who's now at Duke, and colleagues. And they did a study that researchers like me just dream of doing. They sat around and they watched television for a couple of months, and they looked for examples of resuscitation, and then they watched to see whether the person lived or died. And they found that about two-thirds of people who had a cardiac arrest on television lived. The statistics in real life depend on the circumstances, who you are, where you are. Patients in hospitals do better. Patients in ICUs do much better. Young people do better. But across the board, your chances of coming back from a cardiac arrest are probably not much more than 10%. Those numbers go up a little bit if there are bystanders who are able to perform CPR. They go up a lot more if there are bystanders who could do CPR and there's an automatic external defibrillator handy. Under certain circumstances, with the right rhythm and the right people in the right place, your chances could be as much as 1 in 3 of surviving. But still, that's a whole lot less than the two-thirds that those researchers found on television.
And I seem to recall a statistic about people who have in-hospital arrest. So even if, you know, these are patients in hospital where they have very quick access to doctors and nurses, that statistically speaking, if they have an arrest, the likelihood of them leaving the hospital at some point alive is also frightfully low, I would suspect.
It is. It obviously depends on the hospital, and it depends on why you're in the hospital. Those probabilities can be sometimes as low as 2 or 3%, depending on where you are. Sometimes they can be as high as 80 or 90%. In general, though, you're in the hospital because you're sick, and many people have a cardiac arrest in the hospital because of other things that are going on, a really, really bad infection or a lot of bleeding or other problems that are hard to solve. It's one thing to restart somebody's heart, but if you have advanced cancer or severe infection, you can bring somebody back, but you can't necessarily treat those conditions.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Our guest is David Casseret. He's a doctor, a professor of medicine, and director of hospice and palliative medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, where he performs research. He's the author of the new book, Shocked, Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead, just out from Current. And tell us about Michelle Funk. Who was she?
Her story was really amazing. It was her story that made me, years ago, want to become an emergency room doctor. I subsequently became a hospice doctor, so I've strayed a little bit. But back in the 80s, when she was about 2.5 years old, she fell into a creek outside of Salt Lake City in Utah and spent about an hour, as near as people can tell, underwater. Was lifeless, no sign of a heartbeat or breathing when rescuers pulled her out. And no sign of a heartbeat or breathing for another 2 hours. So about 3 hours, she was either underwater or had no heartbeat, wasn't breathing, until finally something happened and her heart started beating. She started breathing spontaneously. And she was alive again after 3 hours of being looking dead. And that really opened my eyes to what was possible in medicine. And it also expanded the horizons, I think, of a lot of people who work in this world of emergency medicine and resuscitation. Because before Michelle Funk died and then came back to life, nobody would have said it was possible to survive after 3 hours. But then all of a sudden it was. And that made many people think about what might be possible someday. 3 hours, maybe 4, maybe 5, maybe a day, who knows?
And you also report about one Japanese office worker who got a little bit off the trail, who also had somewhat of a miraculous experience.
He did. That's Mitsutaka Yukikoshi, who was a 35-year-old office worker, wandered off from a company picnic in Kobe, Japan, back in 2006, and he was found 24 days later, alive. But the interesting thing was that he was alive with a temperature of only 22 degrees Celsius, so much, much colder than the usual 37 degrees Celsius.
And that's, you know, so if we think of normal as 98, that's like a body temperature of 72 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly.
Right, exactly.
Pretty darn cold.
It was, although he wasn't frozen. So unlike other people who have been pulled from chilly water who are frozen, he was alive. He was breathing. He had a heartbeat, but he was breathing very slowly, and he had a very, very slow heart rate. And what caught everybody's imagination was it looked like he was hibernating. He had a low temperature, low heartbeat, low metabolism. The one problem, though, is that human beings don't hibernate. But there was this interesting story of a guy who seemed to be doing just that.
And that was really something your book really fascinated me with, was this whole analogy, or if you will, or this whole stream of research that's going on with hibernation. And it goes off on many tangents, but you look at a couple different animal models and really ask this very interesting question of, could humans ever hibernate? And with a couple of motivations, I think. One is certainly extending life. And of course, then in the science fiction realm, we think about space travel and other means of suspended animation. That was the term I was looking for. Can you share with us what you learned? I mean, you did some great reporting in this book, and there were some types of squirrels I'd never heard of, and the lemur that you mentioned.
Well, thanks. It really was fun. This was one of the most fun chapters to write. And you're right. I think people are interested in the idea of human hibernation, partly for interest in space travel. But I've noticed a lot of the scientists I talk with don't like that term, suspended animation. Because as soon as you say suspended animation, people think about science fiction. And if you're a serious researcher and you're trying to do serious research and you're trying to get funding from serious organizations, you really don't want people thinking about science fiction. So many researchers I spoke with talked about human hibernation, or they talked about hypometabolism, meaning a state of low metabolism.
Yeah, that was such jargon. I appreciate you pointing that out, because I couldn't remember the term, but I knew that they had a sort of pejorative view of that term. But thank you for explaining that. What were these animals?
Well, it helps to know a little bit about the theory first, because that's really fascinating. The idea behind whatever you call it, hypometabolism or human hibernation or suspended animation, is if you can trick the body into a state of lower metabolism, essentially you trick it to shifting gears down a couple of notches, using less oxygen, then you can trick people's organs and their brains in particular into using less oxygen and potentially helping them to survive longer under circumstances where oxygen is in short supply. For instance, somebody who's just experienced a near-drowning event, somebody who's going through a major surgery, a soldier injured on the battlefield. There are lots of situations, you and I both know in medicine, where the brain and other organs aren't getting enough oxygen. So there are a lot of researchers now interested in trying to figure out how we can learn from animals, as you mentioned, like 13-line squirrels or marmots or bears. I talk about each of these examples in the book, or lemurs. Lemurs, as far as we know, are the only primates that hibernate. So the theory is, if we can figure out what those lemurs do to get them to hibernate, there might be a trick there that we could learn from.
And the thing that another fascinating fact, I guess, about the lemurs was they fatten up their tail, essentially, right? And that becomes their source of sustenance while they hibernate?
They do, and it does. And these critters look really, really odd. I went to visit a bunch of lemurs in a lemur sanctuary to meet with a researcher named Peter Klopfer, who was one of the founders of the Duke Lemur Sanctuary in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina. And you walk into a room with these lemurs, and they're these little tiny stuffed animal critters with these enormous fat tails that they drag around with them. I guess it's sufficient, but it makes them look really, really funny.
So the hibernation question, perhaps very logically then, led into further discussion, really, about freezing. Now, going back a little bit on some of the history, it turns out that the Russians, I guess, had a lot of experience or perhaps lacking in some of the technological resources that the Western world had were very early into the idea of freezing. And so tell us about some of the experiments and some of the surgical techniques that are being experimented with that you reported on in the book.
Sure. So what you're referring to is what was known somewhat ominously as the Russian method. But it's based on the very simple theory that if you could trick the body into a state of low metabolism, you could get it to survive surgery or injury or near drowning or situations where there isn't enough oxygen. And so Russians, the story goes, would bury drowning victims or injury victims in the snow, because cold is a really, really good way to get the body's brain and other organs to reduce their metabolism. And back in the early 20th century, there were some researchers who began to experiment with that. The term artificial hibernation was first used in 1905. And there were first French researchers and then researchers in Great Britain in the 50s who would use a combination of drugs and ice, a lot of ice often, to try to get patients through surgeries, often very, very aggressive, invasive surgeries, where survival was low. But the theory was if you could reduce their metabolism enough, then you could get their heart and lungs and brains in particular to survive under those tough circumstances. So they would bury these patients in ice, leaving just enough room to get in to perform whatever surgery they needed to perform. And the interesting thing I discovered, a lot of these experiments, they didn't use anesthesia because they didn't want to confuse the issue. So these patients were going through fairly aggressive surgery with a lot of ice, but not much in the way of anesthesia.
Oy, and what were the success rates like?
It's hard to tell. One researcher named John Wary Dundee was an Irish physician who worked in the UK in the 50s, used a combination of drugs and ice, provided one report of 26 patients, and reported only 5 deaths in those patients. So today, those mortality statistics would be pretty bad. You wouldn't want to go to a surgery that gave you a 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 chance of dying. But back then, that wasn't too bad.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Our guest is David Cassaret. He's a professor of medicine and the director of hospice and palliative medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of the new book, Shocked, Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. It's just out from Current. And I wanted to also carry the logic a bit further. We've talked about the hibernation or human hibernation model or scientific arm in terms of resuscitation science. We talked a little bit about some of the history of freezing, the so-called Russian method. You have a chapter on the cryonauts. Who are the cryonauts, and what are they trying to achieve?
The cryonauts are an odd bunch of folks who welcomed me into their midst and let me spend a weekend with them at a conference in Scottsdale, Arizona. It was a conference sponsored by the Alcor Life Extension Foundation, which promises people that they can be frozen in liquid nitrogen for a period of hundreds, maybe thousands of years, and then revived at the end. And these cryonauts, many of them, have agreed to pay for that privilege. The going rate, by the way, is $70,000 to have your head frozen or $200,000 to have all of you frozen. Patients are frozen in liquid nitrogen and then hoping that in 100 or 500 or 1,000 years, medicine will have advanced to a point at which whatever caused them to die in the first place can be treated, hopefully treated easily, and then they can be revived and come back to rejoin the living.
Now, isn't Alcor Life Extension the company sort of famously or infamously has Ted Williams as one of the, or are you forbidden by HIPAA to discuss that? It was not mentioned in the book, but I thought I remembered that name from when the famous baseball player of the Boston Red Sox had sort of a tough chapter near the end of his life where his children seemed to be in some dispute about what it was their father wanted. But my understanding was he wound up there at Alcor based on what I guess his son, John Henry Williams, wanted.
That's my understanding, too, that he was cryopreserved there, and that information just comes from media reports. I didn't think I would make any friends among the cryonaut community by asking questions. Ted Williams, but at least according to media reports, yes, he is cryopreserved there.
Okay. I just had to clarify that as a someone who wrote his medical school essay on Ted Williams after having read a biography of him. So you also introduce us to a company with the name Suspended Animation Inc., which just really sounds like it's out of an animated, like a Monsters Inc. or something. What does Suspended Animation do?
So this is a company that works in concert with Alcor, the Life Extension Foundation, and they build themselves as sort of a rapid response team. So if you were to die, Suspended Animation Incorporated would send a team to scoop you up, replace your blood with heparinized fluid to prevent clotting, would employ cardiothoracic surgeons to put you on a bypass machine, put your body on a bypass machine, and flush out blood from your veins to prevent clotting, and would take responsibility for freezing you in liquid nitrogen and transporting you back to the Alcor facility where you would be cryopreserved. It's sort of like emergency medical technicians or paramedics for the dead.
I thought that was just so eerie and really did have the feel of science fiction and horror sort of combined when you painted that picture. I want to shift gears a little bit and just ask you about your profession, because you're a doctor and you specialize really in hospice and palliative medicine, and yet this book is really about resuscitation, about bringing the near-dead or perhaps the very vibrant back to life after some kind of tragedy or accident. And I just wondered, is the book an attempt to sort of come full circle after having spent so much time around the dying? Are you trying to, you know, forestall death, or just more curious about learning about the science?
It's really more curiosity about the science. I'm really happy with the work that I do. I find taking care of patients near the end of life and their families incredibly rewarding, as do the other doctors and nurses that I work with. I think we all do what we do because we love what we do, and we really care about our patients. So this was really an attempt to look at the science in a more lighthearted way. I really wanted to write a book about a serious subject, life, death. It doesn't get too much more serious than that, but to write about it in a way that included science, that included interesting history, that was engaging, and that was funny. That was really my goal.
Well, I have to say, the book, that's what surprised me the most. So when I was given the book to review and prepare for this interview, I thought, oh wow, okay, you know, I'm a doctor, I'm pretty interested in this resuscitation science. But I just started reading, and my wife sort of said, well, what are you laughing about? I was just chuckling out loud because the book is so funny, and I agree. I mean, it's not really a topic I would have thought of as funny, but you do it so well, and I was really impressed because, you know, again, here you are, someone who's a doctor dealing with, you know, a very serious, the most serious topic there is. And, you know, you've previously written more along those lines, your previous book. And so was this a chance, was this a latent sense of humor that's come around late, or was this a chance for you to just show what you've always had and just been sort of hiding?
Yeah, I don't think it was a latent sense of humor. I think I'm not that unusual in the hospice and palliative care world. Many of us who work in this area, I think, really are quite funny. I can't speak for myself, but I know that many of the people I work with have an amazing sense of humor, and it's not gallows humor. It's they're just really, I'm fortunate to work with really nice, well-adjusted, often really, really hilarious doctors and nurses. I will say that this book was easy to write. It really was. Often when you sit down to write, any of us, whether it's writing a letter, writing an email, writing a book, it becomes easier if you find the right voice, if you find a voice that's natural. And for this definitely was me. This was easy to write because this is the way I interact with my patients. This is the way I interact with my colleagues. And it was really effortless and fun to write. And hopefully it is to read too. So I'm delighted to hear you say that.
Yeah, no, it really is. I was very, very impressed. And, so who are your literary inspirations? Is there anyone in terms of the reportage here that you're patterning yourself after, or who do you like to read?
That's a great question. I think there are some people who have written in this space, like Mary Roach, who's a journalist whose science writing is well-known, things like Stiff. So I think I've definitely been influenced by her, but I've also been influenced a lot, I've realized, by really, really good travel writers, people like Jonathan Rabin or Tim Cahill or Paul Theroux. I think there's something about good travel writing that's full of mistakes. I mean, the really good travel writing is not an effortless journey from point A to point B. It's an attempted journey from point A to point B that gets derailed and winds up somewhere altogether. And that process of kind of fumbling around and making mistakes makes for really good travel writing. And I tried to do that here, too. I mean, there were surprises, and I try to be transparent about those surprises. And I certainly came at this not knowing much at all and learned along the way, as good travel writers often do. So that was an inspiration as well.
And I understand, too, that you're already at work on the next book, which also is medical in nature, but really reflects more of a broader scientific curiosity. Tell us a little bit about what you're working on now.
Sure. So medical marijuana is not legal yet in Pennsylvania, but many of my patients who are near the end of life are either using it illegally or are thinking about using it, and they've gotten me curious. And so I decided to research and write a book, which will also be published by Penguin Random House in May of next year, about medical marijuana, the science of medical marijuana, the clinical benefits, and some of the risks.
And have you reached any kind of conclusion on the safety of medical marijuana at this point in your reportage?
It's a little bit too soon to tell, but my general impression so far has been that medical marijuana works a whole lot better for more things than I ever thought it would. It's much more beneficial than I had imagined, but it's also more risky. There are more potential harms of medical marijuana. So both on the plus side and the negative side, I've been very surprised in all the researchers I've spoken with and the patients I've met.
Well, the name of the new book is Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. David Casseret is a professor of medicine. He's the director of hospice and palliative care at the University of Pennsylvania. And the book is just out from Current. And Dr. Casseret, congratulations. It's really a phenomenal book. I was delighted to read it, and I wish you great success.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to talk. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed by our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed a show, you can stream them online anytime. Just go to our website, publicradiotulsa.org. Look for Studio Tulsa under the Program tab. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. Thank you.